about legality and hope that it gets to the judicial board. In summary, this triumvirate is unable to deal with the problems except in a legalistic way. However, one must be able to present one's case to EOP and the Anti-Discrimination Committee successfully before one is entitled to legal advice. Secondly, although EOP can suggest goals of hiring for various colleges, it has no way of enforcing these goals. I would wonder why the board set up a situation to put well-intentioned people who work in EOP in the situation to give them no power. Another aspect of what can be changed at the university, and this is hiring. As long as the fraternity system for recruiting faculty and administrative positions exists, anyone not accepted as part of the status quo will never be hired. Therefore, beginning immediately, all professional positions should be posted and advertised as being open to all qualified persons. This is as an amendment to also to the others that have been done, which is all positions should be advertised. All applications should come into a central office from which those seeking new employees may draw. This helps avoid the situation where women's applications or inquiries are filed away or lost. Efforts should first be expended locally to give opportunity to women applicants. We further recommend that the university immediately publish and make widely available employment bulletins which advertise all jobs, clerical, teaching, administrative. No job should be filled that is not advertised. Specific recommendations are outlined in the working paper from the Alliance, which was distributed at the last Board of Trustees meeting. These goals and recommendations must be a top priority so that positive action can be implemented. In other words, there must be more women. There must be women in every department so that curriculum can be looked at, so that hiring can go on. There must be power given to EOP so that when they recommend, they are listened to. Thirdly, a women's center, which would operate as a Kleenex structure, should exist. As the very last part of my presentation, I would like to show you another horror story of what happens to women. Is Mrs. Wilner here? Although Mrs. Wilner can give you a personal account of what happens when you go to the personnel office, it is very typical of the hiring services employed at this university.
Okay. I would like to say, first of all, that I am a woman. I'm a woman with a bachelor's degree from University of Michigan, and I worked for 3 years in the counseling office there. I came to East Lansing after a year abroad, and I went to the personnel office, and the first thing they asked me, I came there at 1 o'clock, and they told me that the typing test was administered at 8 and 3. I told them I was not interested in any job typing. I spoke to a gentleman who gave me a form to fill out. I filled it out, and I never heard anything for 6 months. I went back again, and they said, oh, well, we throw out applications after 6 months. Fill out another application. I did, and I said I was very upset that they had thrown out my application. They showed me the fine print that said they throw them out. But it seems to me that 6 months is hardly time to keep these kind of records, because as I understand it, these jobs come up in some sort of cyclical period. People come and go at sort of regular yearly intervals, and 6 months hardly seems appropriate. However, I then spoke to a gentleman who said, well, in reality, we can't give you any kind of placement except clerical. We do no administrative placing here. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? He said, I suggest you go around from office to office and ask people if they need anyone. I did that. And I'll tell you that it's a disheartening and very ego-bruising experience, because you go in and you say, here I am, and they say, sorry. You have no way of knowing whether they're discriminating against you or not. Do they have a job? You don't know. They just say, sorry. So After 6 months, another 6 months with my name in the file and going from office to office, I've given up. And I just hope that you can put in some system where people like myself can find out whether jobs are available. I feel that I have something to offer the university, and yet the university wants no part of me, really, unless I'm on the inside. I got the distinct feeling that if I was a Michigan State graduate, if I had always been around East Lansing, I'd know about where to go, but I don't know where to go, and so consequently, I'm unemployed. Thank you. Thank you.
Trustees have any questions? Trustee Huff?
Ms. Nyberg, just for the record, the Brookover report was set up to be self-executing. It was placed under a vice president who reported directly to the president, with provision that the president would report periodically to the Board of Trustees on its operations. Now, the conclusion that you reach to the effect that the report and its organization is non-operative is one that I have to concur with. I agree fundamentally with your complaints about the affirmative action report, and I agree with you fundamentally about the lack of effective action we've gotten out of the Brookover report after 2 years. Now, I didn't hear very specifically what your organizational proposal was to change the system. Would you mind repeating that particular point?
Sure.
Specifically, we're asking that EOBP be in charge of cases of discrimination, to stop overburdening that office with having the challenge to come up with programs. They were set up to handle discrimination. That is a huge, huge job. There are not enough people there to do that. Secondly, we recommend that EOP be given specific enforcing powers. That is, if a department is found to be discriminating, if it does not change, then they have the specific recommendation that either money be withheld or no new appointments can be given until these inequities are changed.
Any others? Thank you. Ms. Nyberg, in it, that next was Barry Thorne. No? Colette Moser.
Barry and I have had a mini caucus and decided that given the more general nature of my comments, that I should proceed her, and much of her analysis will develop some of the observations which I'm making. My purpose in speaking before the Board of Trustees today is to show the interconnection between the economic status of women and the role of the university. This connection, as I see it, is that to the extent that the university produces education, research, and public services, women are, in the jargon of the economist, both inputs and outputs in that production function. In their roles as producers and recipients of the services of the university, they encounter economic problems and restrictions which are, for the most part, unique to women. I'm speaking today as a representative of the Alliance to End Sex Discrimination at MSU because it is the only organization, to my knowledge, which seeks to examine the totality of the problems of women as inputs and outputs of the university. A goal of the Alliance is that it will be superseded by a university-recognized and supported institutional structure, which will fulfill this responsibility of meeting the needs of women in their various roles. In terms of the specific economic aspects of the role of women as inputs to the university community, there are many areas in which women are discriminated against or at least have to overcome serious barriers. Some of these matters include the following. One, differences in salaries and in titles between men and women doing essentially the same work. Two, low wages for what is considered women's work, that is clerical, cleaning work, etc. Three, de facto restrictions for promotional opportunities for women in most occupational categories. Four, limited, if any, provisions for upgrading and training women employees so that they may compete for the high-paying managerial and administrative positions. And five, an insensitivity to the current responsibilities of women in the domestic and family areas. This insensitivity manifests itself in such manners as limited access to child care facilities, restrictive leaves of absence, and a punitive policy toward part-time employment, which involves loss of fringe benefits, lower prorated earnings in some cases, and in some areas of work, no job opportunities at all. The impacts of this insensitivity on the earnings and learning opportunities between men and women are tremendous. The university may complain that the costs of changing some of these policies may be prohibitive. I submit that in many of these areas, the university has not even attempted to calculate the price tag of the alternatives, which would give women equal access to opportunities for earning and learning. Let's take, for example, the question of the lower annuities, which accrue to the female faculty recipients of TIA CREF. How much of a cost saving can there be by giving women less money per year of retirement when women constitute only about 10% of the university faculty? Because of the time limitation, I should like to move quickly to the economic issues surrounding women and the outputs of the university. In terms of the university's research output, we need much more of it directed toward the kinds of women's issues which will be identified at this meeting. In terms of public service, the opportunities are numerous for the university, particularly a land-grant university, to alleviate the hardships which many women face. After all, there are twice as many women as men below the poverty income level. The unemployment rate for women is about twice that for men, and every minority group is 50% or more female. A most important area for examination on the part of the university is that of its educational output of women. From an economist's point of view, I believe that a university which charges the same rate of tuition and fees for its female and male students should be concerned that its female graduates have as many opportunities as its male graduates for utilizing their resources in education. Yet when we compare the differences in earnings and earning potential between men and women college graduates, we find women earning less than their male counterparts. Much of the difference is related to the types of occupations which women enter. But even when they do enter the professional, technical, and scientific fields, their earnings are only about 80% of male earnings. As we examine the data on earnings and employment patterns of women and women college graduates, one of the most striking features is the concentration of women in a much more limited number of occupations than are men. We all know of the concentration of women generally in the clerical field. This concentration is increasing rather than decreasing. Many female college graduates who are not trained for this occupational field are forced to enter it because of the limited alternatives. In fact, I might point out that nationally, clerical work and service work and of the waitress, beautician type and blue-collar operatives account for 70% of the employment of women. In the professions, women college graduates are concentrated in elementary and high school teaching fields, fields, incidentally, which are experiencing a serious oversupply of workers. On the other hand, only 4.3% of women workers in 1968 were in the managerial category of occupations. And incidentally, in 1950, this percentage was 5.5%, so it's actually decreasing. Now, the important thing here is that 20%, about 20% of females over 21 are college graduates, and yet only about 4% are in the managerial field. However, while 26% of the males over age 21 are college graduates, there are six times as many males as female males in these managerial categories. Making more women aware of the potential for employment, the myriad of occupations for which they could train and enter, the reality of the modern-day labor force participation patterns of women, in which single women can expect 40 years of labor force participation and married women at least 25 years of labor force participation, are matters of concern for a university which adheres to policies of equal opportunities and maximum development of human potential.
Thank you. Any questions? Trustee Carrigan?
I might just make a comment, since you alluded to TIAA-CREF, that the president of TIAA-CREF met with the board in open session last night and explained that by law, for reasons which I won't go into here, but would be glad to at some other time, insurance organizations providing annuity plans of this sort cannot equal out the monies between men and women, and the only way for women to be paid equally from that source is for a larger amount of money to be accumulated. There is a way that the university, of course, can address this, and that is by increasing the accumulation. The administration has agreed to look into this and report back to the board how it might be done and what would be involved. I think there are a number of women here who have an interest in that plan, so I mention it for that reason.
Thank you very much. Florence Stevenson? Or Barry? Okay, Barry Thorne.
I would like to speak about some of the attitudes, expectations, and waste of human resources that lie behind some of the statistics we've been hearing about today. Women as a whole comprise 51% of the nation's human resources, but they have a potential which is not being appreciated, encouraged, or fully developed. One can summarize the statistics about women in the university and indeed in the workforce as a whole by a simple rule of thumb. The higher, the fewer. The higher one goes in the hierarchy of status, income, prestige, influence, responsibility, and probably challenging work, the fewer women one finds, until when you reach the top as top administrative posts and tenured full faculty positions in this university, women are practically invisible. Now, this structure is the result of a very vast and long sifting process. Some of the channeling is overt. Women with ambition for the higher slots have to run an obstacle course, which we've heard about today, to even get admitted to graduate or professional school once they've made it that far, to get financial aid, or to find employment once they are trained. What I'd like to talk about is a more slippery and subtle, but I think nonetheless powerful area of sifting and sorting, which is the subtle way in which women are urged to lower their aspirations. This begins in childhood and continues thereon, and the university is very much part of this process. From the time of childhood, a female child who may want to be a doctor is repetitively told that it would be more appropriate for her to become a nurse. A woman with a dream of becoming a politician will probably find herself directed to a secretarial course. The prevalent attitude, I've noticed this and have been told this by many graduates here among both their family and faculty members in the university, and there's a prevalent attitude that it's all right for a woman to get a BA, to go to 4 years of college. That's almost a ticket for being in the middle class. But to go on to seek graduate or professional training would somehow be unfeminine, that it would somehow cut into one's identity as a woman. Now, this kind of attitude shows up in lots of comments that can be heard in conversations and in classrooms, and I'll give some examples in a minute. It also shows up in specific counseling procedures. One of my best students, who happens to be a woman, I object to always saying one of my best woman students because I believe in equality of judgment, but one of my best students went to the MSU Counseling Center and took a career aptitude test. Her highest scores by far were in the fields of law and politics and scientific research. But when she saw a counselor to get an interpretation of her scores, the counselor ignored her top scores and looked down until she found until the counselor found library science. And then the counseling was directed to urging this woman to become a librarian. Now, I think this is the kind of counseling and the kind of stereotypes about women and what they should aspire to do, which one can find throughout the university. I think one reason that women's aspirations are lowered is because they have a visibly lower chance of success than men. In sociology, we refer to this as a lack of role models, which is again a piece of jargon, which I think has meaning. The sheer absence of women in faculty or administrative positions gives a silent but very powerful message to women students that it would be foolish and at the minimum unrealistic to aim too high. In my department, for example, this year there are 25 full-time teaching faculty. I am the only woman, and we train a third of our graduate students are women. Apparently, departments are willing to train women but not to hire them. In any case, I've had a number of undergraduate women come and tell me, these are usually women who tell me this, and I think this is part of the role model and identification idea, that I'm the only female teacher they have had at MSU. People often express surprise when I answer the phone and they say Dr. Thorne and they hear a female voice. Often they refuse to believe that I'm a professor and not a secretary. So that's the kind of expectations one finds in the university. A lot of these expectations come out in comments that one can overhear in conversations and in classrooms. Now, comments and little bits of joking and little tidbits of conversations are not trivial. They reveal a lot about underlying attitudes and expectations, and they can't help but have an effect on behavior. Women in other universities have gathered some of these comments. I haven't had the time to go around and do it here, but I can't believe that MSU is an exception to this. Let me give you just a sampling of them. One graduate student woman was told by a faculty member in her department, "A pretty girl like you will certainly get married. Why don't you stop with an MA?" In a medical school class, a teacher said, "I just don't like women as doctors. They belong at home cooking and cleaning." Another woman was told, "You're so cute, I can't see you as a professor of anything." And finally, a comment, the gist of which is heard again and again, "Somehow I can never take women in this field seriously." Now, remarks of that last kind are perhaps the most frequent, and I think they are one of the biggest burdens that women have to bear. Women graduate students find again and again that they are interrogated about how serious they are in terms of their goal and career aspirations. Male students are not asked, "Are you serious about this?" This is taken for granted. But this kind of interrogation of women about how serious they are reflects an underlying attitude that women as a group are not to be taken seriously. I think that women who work as well as women students often confront this attitude. There is an attitude, for example, about working women, that somehow the work they do is temporary, that it's only to bring in pin money or luxuries to the household, and that it somehow doesn't count quite as much as the work that men do. Now, this kind of attitude flies in the face of fact. Two-thirds of working women, of women who work full-time, supply the basic income for themselves and or their families. Women's work is a serious economic matter as well as a serious personal matter. In terms of education, the kinds of comments that I've given a sampling of reflect the expectation that women students are expected to be decorative objects, but not serious and equal participants in the classroom. There is a general stereotype that I've confronted a number of times that women are expected to be intellectually inferior. They may be grinds, they may get good grades, but it's because they basically do the work in a kind of grinding way. But flashes of creativity and brilliance are somehow reserved for men. There is also an expectation that women students are not likely to finish a PhD. If they do, that they are not likely to work, and I'll speak in a minute about these myths. And also that if you do get a PhD, there must be something wrong with you. You must be something less than a woman. Now, that kind of attitude is very hard to bear. It's a subtle thing, but I think it's powerful in redirecting aspirations. I'd like to point out in this connection that women face many of the same problems that confront members of ethnic minorities. A woman is less likely to be judged on her own merits than as a member of a category for which there is a highly developed stereotype. And in the case of academic women, a stereotype that has characteristics that run counter to academic demands. In other words, women are judged in advance by what they might do given the stereotype rather than what they might have done or what they are like as individual human beings. Finally, I would like to talk about some of the myths that are used often to justify discriminatory procedures, and that, again, we have very good facts that show that the myths are not true. First of all, in the face of the kinds of barriers I've mentioned, it's not surprising that we find the pattern of the higher, the fewer. That as one moves up, you find fewer women. And it's also not surprising that many women internalize these cultural attitudes, have a diminished self-esteem, and develop a sense of inferiority. And this is a tremendous human cost to pay. I'd like to emphasize that. I feel it very strongly. But in the face of this discouragement, what you find is that the bulk of the attrition rate of women in the educational sequence is not during a given stage of training, but between stages. And I emphasize that because one of the myths I've heard again and again used to justify quotas for women in admitting them to graduate departments or giving them less financial aid than male students is that they are not a good investment. Again, the economic metaphor is often used. That they are likely to drop out during the course of training, that they just won't finish. Oh, you'll just get married and have children and leave, that kind of statement. However, the facts do not tend to substantiate this. The bulk of the attrition rate of women happens after each successive stage of training. In other words, after high school years, then a lot of women leave the educational sequence. After the BA, you have another influx or outflux. After the MA, it happens again. But we do have some statistics from universities, and we need far more studies of attrition rates. I think this whole subject or science is in its infancy. But there are studies that indicate that in many cases and in many programs, women actually have a lower attrition rate than men. For example, in some undergraduate programs, it has been found that not only do female students have a higher grade point average than male students, but that more women than men complete the 4 years. The University of Chicago did a study of attrition rates among graduate students and found that there were very few differences between male and female students, and that women actually had a lower attrition rate than men in the humanities, where fewer fellowships are available. So that showed even more tenacity in staying with a program. Now, I'm not denying that in some programs women have higher attrition rates, and I think we can see clearly some of the reasons why. But the statistics do not tend to support the myth that is widely used to justify discriminatory practices. I'll conclude with just two other myths and a few facts. There is a myth that the job turnover rate and sick leave rate of women is higher than that of men. However, the Women's Bureau and the Department of Labor has found that if you standardize comparisons for occupation and income, which is the meaningful way to look at these statistics, you find, in fact, that the sick leave and turnover rates for women are actually slightly lower than those of men. again a fact that needs to be known to demolish a myth that's been used to keep women down. And a final myth, which has been used to justify various policies, is that even if women get PhDs, they'll just get married and have children and drop out, that they may complete schooling, but they surely won't continue to work, so what's the use of training them? We have a very good survey done of the 2,000 women who got PhDs in the U.S. in 1957 to 1958. In a follow-up study 10 years later, they found that 91% of these women were working. So in fact, it is not the case that female PhDs don't use their education or that they drop out. I think there are several obvious conclusions to be drawn from this. First of all, that women, as other kinds of minority groups, are the victims of stereotypes and myths. That women are not, in fact, treated on an equal and fair basis in the university. And the result of this, I think, is a kind of tragedy in terms of human cost and unrealized potential.
Thank you. Ms. Thorne.
Professor Barry.
Ms. Thorne. I'm sorry. Trustee Huff has a question.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very interesting presentation. My question is to draw you out a little more on these myths, and you're just exactly the right person to ask. Is it not true, or is it part of my information, my misinformation, that women themselves, to a very considerable extent, perpetrate and perpetuate these myths?
I think that's true, and I think it's because women have internalized the kinds of assumptions and expectations that are true throughout society. Yes, I agree with that. I think it makes the situation no less just. I think women
I agree. My
that
question,
do great injustices to
my
themselves.
My question wasn't an argumentative one. I wanted to bring that point out, but because I'm really addressing it, I guess, in this case, to the audience.
Yeah, right. And I think that's why we have a vast educative job to do among women as well as men. You know,
Now my second question is, how do you turn these myths around? As a sociologist, how do you turn them around?
I think, for one thing, that you have to take action. I mean, prior to that, one obvious thing is that we have to get more publicity about the facts, and that's the value of this kind of hearing. And it's partly a job of education. I would like, for example, for us to have more content about women in the curricula. You'll find in sociology, for example, that in courses, the only place typically where women are studied is in courses on the family, and often in a very stereotyped kind of assumption about women in the role of full-time homemaker and mother. You know, there is very little about working women, for example. And in history courses, there is very little about the contributions of women to history. So I think part of the answer is education and publicity. But I think another part is action, as I said, and action of the kind of just simply hiring more women faculty so women students can see that it's possible. I've just been touched. I had a student come to me in the fall. I had a lecture course of 100 students. One of the students came in my office and she said, almost wide-eyed, how did you get where you are? She couldn't imagine that a woman could be there or what the sequence of actions one could take would be that would lead to that position, you know. So I think that it's both action of getting more women in higher positions is crucial to this, as well as education, and that the two will go hand in hand.
Trustee Stevens?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just like to say that you're absolutely right about the myths and the stereotypes and so forth that exist. I have to give you one example of my own shortcomings in that regard. One time I took our family dog over to the veterinarian, and I walked in, and out of the door where the veterinarian would be coming came a very beautiful young girl. And I looked around a while, and finally I said, could I speak to the doctor? She said, well, sir, I am the doctor. Mm-hmm. So you see, we all have those images.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next, Florence Stevenson.
I guess I'm the most called on person here this afternoon, but I promise only to speak once. I will speak about the area of continuing education for women. And I think that this field is reaping the harvest that's sown by the conditions pointed out by Dr. Thorne. We wouldn't have any need for continuing education for women had women been free to be educated at an earlier period in their life. Between 1950 and 1969, the number of women college students increased more than four times. It reached a total of 3,222,000. During this period, the population of girls aged 18 to 21 increased less than 60%. But among women aged 25 to 29, school enrollment rose from 26,000 to 311,000. And among women aged 30 to 45 years of age, 21,000 to 215,000 students. And in the workforce, during the same period, 1950 to 1969, there were 12 million additional women, 62% of whom were 35 years of age and over. The greatest change in the proportion engaged in paid employment was recorded for women between 45 and 54 years of age, which rose from 25% in 1940 to 37% in 1969. As we get a shorter work week, which is inevitable, it will mean that there will be more opportunities for both men and women to work at a more leisurely pace, at a more realistic pace, not just that as women come into the labor force, it means men are being forced out. If we take the attitude that there is a place for equality and we are dedicated to it, we cannot look at the situation in the light of where a woman takes a job, it means a man is threatened. This smacks of the kind of mentality that thought the horseless carriage would never last. Factors contributing to women's interest in college attendance include the early age of marriage, which in 1970, the median age was 20.8, the frequent changes in women's pattern of living, and their lengthened lifespan, which has increased 26 years since 1900. A publication of the Women's Bureau called Continuing Education Programs and Services for Women in its 1971 revision listed 375 special programs for women reported by various colleges and universities nationwide. In addition, there were 60 other related services or programs for adult women which extend beyond their specific campuses. This type of activity originated in the early 60s in such schools as Radcliffe, Sarah Lawrence, the University of Minnesota, and the University of Michigan. That Center for Continuing Education for Women at Ann Arbor reported an increase from 1970 to 1971 of 43% of the women whom they counseled. The Women's Bureau did a study on alumni of college and universities and reported that their most frequent request was to have counselors who were competent to advise them about counseling and educational plans. College counselors who spend most of their time working with younger people often do not realize the special problems associated with continuing family responsibilities and reentry into the labor force at a mature age. The alumni also felt that many of their counselors were not aware of existing services and facilities that could help in solving their problems. One of the greatest needs of women who are returning to school is a need to develop their individual potential and to achieve something with their lives. The confidence to attempt this reentry is one of their greatest hurdles. As Dr. Thorne would be the first to agree, men are socialized to be confident, to act that way, and they are supported in this from the time of infancy and childhood. Women's image has been to be helpless. So it takes some encouragement and some assistance in many cases to overcome this socialization that they have lived with their lifelong. The Women's Bureau study
reported women with recent university courses found criticism of method and content. They felt that many of the courses could not satisfy women with considerable life experience. Other women had difficulty locating classes that reviewed and updated basic information in their fields of interest. Many reported that the hours during which local colleges offered courses were not convenient for them. They needed classes during daytime, on Saturday, or in the summer, and in the evening. Some alumni also expressed interest in accelerated courses during the time they were preparing for employment. Successful features offered by some colleges and universities are limited course loads in degree and non-degree programs, flexible scheduling of classes, liberal provision for transfer of credits, educational and employment counseling, financial assistance for part-time study, nursery services, job placement, or referral services, and, of course, something along the line of an external degree, perhaps general studies or something like that, which would benefit women and men. Concern has been voiced for the needs, still largely unmet, of groups such as low-income women, mothers with young children, employed women wishing executive, professional, or supervisory training, and formerly married women, now widowed or divorced. We are in the business of education, and we have the responsibility to reach out to those who need it. In view of the national trends about the numbers of women, the increasing numbers who are returning to education, I checked with our registrar, and in the fall term, when we had something along the line of 41,000 students enrolled, only 1,956 were women over 25 years of age. I was astonished at this, to say the least. He did qualify it by saying he could only use the statistics that people reported, and he inferred that some women did not report their age. But at another school, which I know well, almost one-third of the women students were over 25 years of age, and it is barely possible that this discrepancy may be indicative of a lack of sensitivity, an actual turning away of some of these older people, because I have talked with many who have felt the difficulties were too great. They simply couldn't cope with trying to come back in the face of all the requirements and complications, which were not relevant to their particular situation. In accordance with what is proven valuable in the experience of other campuses and as suggested in previous Alliance papers, there is a need for a women's center at Michigan State University. It could provide, among others, the following services of benefit to women wishing to continue their education: counseling, problem solving, and referral. Information services. Liaison between academic requirements and the unique problems of mature women, both within Michigan State University and between it and other institutions of higher education. Placement assistance, particularly in the areas such as part-time employment opportunities, job sharing, and this sort of thing, and working with employers to increase management positions for women. I think Mrs. Wilner's case is one that could well fit into this category also. Financial aid, particularly for part-time women students. Research relating to women. Library materials of relevance to women. Meeting space for informal groups. Workshops and special daytime courses. It is to be hoped that within 20 years or so, there would not be the need for these special services. But at this time, there certainly does seem to be a very great need, which Michigan State has not been really concerned about. I hope that this will be one of the things which can change.
Thank you. Trustee Huff.
I would take it that you would agree that for some of these proposals, you need special personnel and special emphasis for minority groups. You didn't say so here. This is directed at all women. But in some of these cases here, the problems of the poor and those who suffer, in a sense, you might say, a double dip of discrimination.
Yes, I think that's true.
Have special problems,
even beyond
what you've mentioned here.
Yes, where there have been discrepancies and inequities,
particular effort is needed to overcome them, whatever the area.
Yeah, the role of white women is tough enough, but the role of black women is compounded.
Right.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you. Next, I believe we have Jacqueline Brophy.
I want to speak very briefly of the university as employer and summarize the pattern of inequities in compensation between men and women that develops from such salary information as is available about this university. The pattern seems to be this. One, colleges and schools with a high proportion of women tend on the faculty tend to have much lower salaries than other colleges and departments. Two, salaries of men in the same rank and in the same colleges are, for the most part, higher than women in that rank and college. Three, and importantly, we need to know how long an individual is in a given rank before promotion to the next rank. And we urge the university to make this information available without delay. The information may provide a defense against this charge. We do not know, but it seems to us that that women do stay longer in rank before promotion, and we need to know this for a fact before we can take the university can, before the university can take the steps that are needed to rectify this particular inequity. Four, part-time faculty and academic support personnel are frequently called temporary. Many of them are women, and they are not really temporary, a good many of them, as Mrs. Blackman revealed in her evidence earlier today. These part-time employees, if they are not temporary, if their employment is needed by the university, and if they continue in it year after year, of course, should be allotted the same rights to promotion, to salary increases, to health retirement, health benefits, retirement benefits, and all the benefits, the fringe benefits, on a prorated basis. This has been lacking to a great extent in the past. In other categories of employment other than faculty, in the administrative and professional categories, clerical and technical, maintenance, food service, and other work, though there's some differences in salaries in particular job categories, it's usually the fact that there may be a different job title for essentially the same work. The job title given to the woman is paid lower than the job title given to the man. And this is not equal pay for equal work. And the rules and regulations and the court cases have upheld the interpretation that equal work does not mean identical, but substantially similar. And that, for example, as one college got into trouble because they paid the sweeper, the janitor who swept out the boiler room more than the janitress who swept out the dining hall. This, they said, was not sufficient to give it a different job category and different pay. And one of the most flagrant examples, I would assume, in this university and many other places, are in the positions of executive secretary as compared with administrative assistant. Very often the work they do is substantially the same, and the rates of compensation are drastically different, and needless to say, it's usually the woman in the lower rated title and the men in the higher rated title. This is a very brief summary, and not new to those of us who have been paying attention to these matters in the past year, But I urge, and the Alliance urges, that the university give priority to rectifying these particular inequities in the next salary adjustment.
Thank you. Do any of the trustees have any questions? Thank you. Next, also from the Monsieur Williams Alliance, Elizabeth Santos.
I brought with me today some material that I would like to submit on behalf of another person today. He cannot be here to submit his testimony, but he would have liked to have. The person I'm talking about is Dr. Daniel Kruger of the Department of Labor Industrial Relations here at MSU. He is a consultant to the governor on manpower problems, and just this past week he spoke before the United States House of Representatives to the Subcommittee on Labor in Washington. And I'd like to give you a couple of quotes that are indicative of Dr. Daniel Kruger's feelings on the subject. He says that the wealth of the nation is found in the quality of its human resources and their utilization. Women have been denied equality of opportunity, they have been denied quality of access to the better jobs, and they have been denied development of their human resources. He also gives, sends to you some suggested steps in the right direction to eliminate sex discrimination in employment. An article that he wrote several years ago, printed in Business Topics, entitled Women at Work. And Dr. Daniel Kruger, I will say this for him, has been interested in women's problems in employment for over 10 years now, and I think that he's a well-known expert in the underutilization of women as workers. This is his most famous quote, or to me, it's my favorite. He says, "The greatest waste of human resources in the United States today is the underutilization of intelligent women." So I submit all of this stuff to you on his behalf. Now, if I may begin with my own, I hope. What I'm going to try to do today is to bring to you a real situation and try to make it more real to you, the problems of women, by getting down to the nitty-gritty and by getting into their everyday, daily lives and their ordinary kinds of problems. I hope that you'll be able to understand, being far removed from the problem as you are, that what the problems really are, okay? Some of women's worst problems are commonplace ones, often overlooked as being of no significance. I want to try for you to imagine yourself in this particular situation and reflect as what a drag it would be on your achievements. I wonder how many men have had to prepare for a very important testimony, a very important meeting, with a crying baby pulling at their leg all day long and a sick baby all week long, demanding your full attention and following you around the house everywhere you go so that there's no place you can have any privacy. No men, they lock themselves away in their offices and they tell their secretaries, "I don't want to be interrupted until I finish this work." My husband says that the atmosphere in our home distracts him so much that he has to go to his office regularly at night to do his studying. Yet he wonders why I don't take a course, because I've got so much time at home with nothing else to do but study. I am never alone or free from tending to the baby for a minute, except when I leave him at home to tend to the baby. I find that thoughtful, careful preparation of material is very hard to accomplish, and indeed any creative or intellectual activity is really a struggle. I doubt that many of you men could continue to function in such a continuously stressful and demanding condition with no relief, no escape, no privacy, and no compensation. I came here today to disclose the hideous crimes that have been committed against women by this community, by this university, and perpetuated by you, the administrators of the policy, and also by the society itself. It has been a conspiracy with the past and present people in the community and with the past and present administrations and the whole social order. I wish that you could understand how elitist this public educational institution really is. The whole system is geared for the education of one group. The white, middle-class boy who has just graduated from high school and is still single. This university has literally pushed out thousands of young women who marry while they're still students, not to mention others they've pushed out. They cannot get financial aid enough for both of them to continue in school, so the woman has to quit and put her husband through. They end up living in MSU's Harlem when the girl's modern contraceptive doesn't work. When the girl's modern contraceptive doesn't work, they become a poverty family, and the child at 6 weeks old ends up being one of the 100 abused and neglected children left with the next door neighbor who already has a bundle of her own, and she's depressed and overworked. And she must take care of these children to put her husband through because she can't get out and get a job. One of these women called me on the telephone one day when my name was in the paper with my phone number just to call and tell me that she wanted somebody to talk to, and she ended up crying on the phone for 2 hours because she had 9 kids to take care of all week long, 3 of her own and 6 of other people's, and the only minute she had during the whole week of privacy, 7 days out of that week, was a few minutes when she went to Mass on Sunday morning. What about the older women, the single or divorced women with children? These women are forced on welfare, and then society complains about having to pay for it. They and 2 children live on $250 total income a month. That's less than 1 male student who lives in a dorm and eats. Where is the scholarship money for these motivated women? Where is the financial aid for them if they can only attend classes part-time? Where is the child care for them? Where is the medical aid for their sick children? For 100 years, this university has brought hundreds of thousands of women into this area and deprived them of expert medical care for their female illnesses, care that they would have gotten if they were still working or still living at home with their parents. Thousands of MSU students have had painful abortions or been burdened for life with an unwanted child inflicted upon them by another male MSU student. There has been endless pain and suffering among your women students because they've had nowhere to go for female illnesses, mental or physical, except to a doctor who laughs and says, "Menstrual cramps must be endured because you're a woman," or "Vaginal infections," they tell you, "are expected to be expected if you continue to have sexual intercourse." There are 2 outstanding and imminent needs that I see that I would like to think that should be dealt with immediately, and they're the foundation for solving a multitude of related problems. The first of these is the official establishment of a women's center along the lines of the Center for Urban Affairs, and hopefully with similar generosity and funding. Essentially, it is its success in solving women's problems and meeting their needs would be have an administrator, a woman of course, at the level of vice president of this university with the full authority and funding and flexibility to do this position. The second overwhelming pressing need is for this university to commit itself to providing child care for all its employees, faculty, and students. A token beginning was made last year with the Spartan Village Daycare Center. But do not content yourselves that you have satisfied the demand. That center is only a candle in the dark. I am a married student representative on the policy board, and I am deeply aware that it is not big enough or comprehensive enough in filling the needs, even of just the married students. It is estimated that there is a need among the university community for 10 to 15 more of these same size daycare centers, just like the one. The need for more comprehensive child care facilities is painful and depressing among a large number of needy married student families. There are many children in MSU's married housing ghetto who are malnourished, overcrowded, mistreated, and neglected because their parents are busy trying to support themselves. Even many more are in desperate need of total health care that both is not available and can't be afforded. The income range of married student families is $2,400 a year, and a high is $6,000 a year. The poverty level in the country, as you know, is $3,600 a year, and the official minimum income level for minimum needs established by the government is $6,400 a year. How do you really expect any of these families that live in married housing to be able to afford the $100 a month fee charged per child for child care at this center? For the neediest families, this is half of their monthly income, and the other half goes to the university to pay their rent. Under these desperate conditions, what happens to a woman, widowed or divorced, with two children who can't support her family, so she goes to college full or part-time to get training while living on welfare or ADC? I personally know quite a few of these women who can't even afford to live in married housing, so they have to live in a hovel in the community. She can't afford health care for herself or for her children and must leave her children anywhere she can, and almost always the care they get is inadequate. It is not just these extremely needy families who can't afford the child care fees, even if they are one of the few who can get admitted to the center. There are many student wives sitting home tending their small children who want to be and need to be in college with their husbands, but they can't because they can't get and can't afford child care. This condition is harmful to the whole future of our society and our well-being of the women and the children. It is a social trap that entices young women into the wife and motherhood role of marriage and a family, and then proceeds to punish her for the rest of her life by taking away her opportunities or making them unhumanly difficult. I ask you to have a social conscience and free our young women and give them the same choices that their men have. This is one stereotype. There is one stereotypical situation that I would like to go into detail about because I think not enough is talked about it, and it brings to light many social problems. I want you to think more about the all too frequent typical young co-ed who comes to college, finds a guy that she wants to marry, quits school so that she can support her husband to continue in school, and she goes back to work. Later on, she has one or two or three children and continues working before and after the children are born, believing that she is helping the family toward a better future. Sometime later, her husband graduates. He's a highly educated man, talented, respected, and with his intellect and interest fairly sophisticated. He gets bored with the common interest in activities of a wife who drudges through her work and then the humdrum of housework and tending to the kids. He decides this is not the vivacious co-ed that he fell in love with, and he aspires to a more stimulating marital relationship for the rest of his life. The wife he left behind then has nothing in common with him anymore and can't keep up with him, so they get a divorce. And if you don't believe how frequent this story is, just look at the statistics of just what goes on in married housing. I have done this. So much for the much praised practice of putting hubby through college. Because of the supportive systems at this university, there is no choice for most student families to approach their education on an equal basis. One must sacrifice for the other. What a cruel choice. The student wife is the most abused of all people in the student community, especially if she has a child and has to work. She is forced to be underemployed and underpaid because there's so many like her and she has to get a job somewhere. These thousands of student wives need medical care that they can't afford. They need gynecologists, obstetricians, pediatricians. The local doctors won't take on new patients, especially if they're students or student wives. These young women need a night class degree program. They need acceptance as a part-time degree-seeking student. They need better transportation in the community, for not all married students live in married housing. They need scholarships, grants, adequate loans, and most of all, supportive services when they're admitted, such as women counselors and advisors, especially trained to understand and be sympathetic and supportive of their special problems as women students. Young women facing the frustrations of an identity crisis of being the other sex in a male-dominated society are abused and confused by male therapists, male counselors, and male academic advisors who don't understand their dilemma and are not sympathetic to the needs to be a whole person, admired and respected for who they are. Frequently advise these women who are having problems to take the path of least resistance and conform to their traditional submissive and subordinate woman's place. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Trustee Carrigan, just a minute. Sorry. Trustee Carrigan.
This is a comment that I simply cannot refrain from making. President Horton has said on many occasions that universities must be the repositories of the humane. If that is the case, I have to say our cup at Michigan State runneth over. I think we have heard more humaneness and compassion expressed this afternoon than I've heard in a long time.
Thank you. I hope that compassion runs over in all of your decision making.
I hope so too.
Are there any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. May I ask that those who do have written statements to please supply copies at the back of the room, if possible. Next, we have Estelle Levin, instructor in continuing education.